From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. You all appreciate it. Dear mama, place no one above you. You all appreciate it. Tomorrow is Mother's Day. For most of us, our mom is the first person who nourished us. And our moms remain the number one influence on how we cook, eat, and experience food. So we thought we'd ask a few of our favorite people how their mothers shaped their food journeys.
My mom has always been a huge influence in my life. You know, when people ask me who's my mentor, it's easy for me. It's my mom. She was there to show me the first way, how to cut something properly, and also how to clean something properly. So she's my biggest hero. She's the one that I look to when I need some inspiration, and I couldn't picture doing this without her.
I always describe my mom as a tiger. She's a tiger zodiac. She is a feisty person. She's kind of the voice of our family, very much a pack leader, I think. And I was able to tell these stories about the kitchen because of the food that she was teaching me about. It was through the conversations I had with my mom sitting across from her at the kitchen island. She would cook in this way that was so just open. And what I mean by that is she taught me that in order to cook well, you have to be in the mood for it. I realized that she would just cook throughout the day as she had time and as she wanted to. And she would never cook when she didn't have to. And that worked out because there was all this food in the fridge that she had made previously. And while sitting across from her in that kitchen, I just heard stories she would tell me about when she was little in Korea and when she was a teenager, when she was in college. And these stories that just never came out, even out of her mouth, for years, because what food does is it helps you tap into old memories, not just any memories, but memories that you had forgotten you even had. And so I learned so much about my mother as a person, I think. And that was one of the biggest journeys of this book. And one reason why I really recommend people to stand by their parents' side and watch them cook and learn a recipe and interview them, you know? All this is very new to her, and it's just very casual about everything. And I was like, I wrote a book. It's kind of a big deal, and hundreds of people are going to come to these events. She's like, oh, yeah, I'm so proud of you. That's great. It wasn't until someone from church, that lady was like, hey, I read this great piece by Eric Kim in the New York Times. And my mom was like, that's my son. And then I think that's when she realized. She's like, oh, you're doing something here.
We grew up cooking Caribbean food. Our family are from Jamaica. And we grew up in South London, and we were raised in a very much Caribbean household. So food was very prominent in our lives, not just the food, but also family get-togethers. That's often when a lot of food was there. And we just always used to help my mum in the kitchen and our grandmother in the kitchen. So we started cooking just by learning off of them.
I went on a vegan journey myself for a year between 2017 and 2018. And my mum was actually inspired by that.
My mum at the time was having challenges with diabetes, etc. So she just thought, switch up her diet to see if that will help to improve her cholesterol level, and which it did. And she's been a vegan ever since.
My earliest memories of my mom giving me kind of this confidence and understanding of food was her teaching me how to make a proper cup of tea. That was such a way of her giving me a bit of her understanding of the tradition of drinking tea and how it's this big part of her culture. And I say culture, and I mean that having the process of making a cup of tea, it's so ritualistic. And it felt like a ritual to make it with her. That part of her and her passion and love for that soothing comfort of having a cup of tea was something that I wanted to be able to offer her. So while she was sick and while she was, you know, I came back home, that was the one thing left that she could still partake upon with eating. As her cancer progressively got worse, it was less about food intake and was more about just getting her to drink some fluid. So the ritual of making tea was really this understanding of my mother and rituals and holding on to traditions.
You just heard from a handful of chefs and authors, Kwame Onwuachi, Eric Kim, brothers Craig and Sean McAnuff, and Suzanne Barr talking about their moms. Suzanne will be back on Good Food next week for a longer conversation about her memoir, My Aki Tree. And Kwame will return in a few weeks to talk about his cookbook, My America.
She's fair and she is quiet, Lord. She doesn't look like me. She made me love the morning, she's a holiday at sea. The New York streets are as busy as they always used to be. But I am the mother of Evangeline.
Coming up, a lighthearted novel offers rich lessons about cuisine and culture in Los Angeles.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. If you love food history and live or grew up in Los Angeles, I have your next airport or swimming pool read. The new novel, Love and Saffron, took me back to growing up with a single mom in Los Angeles in the 60s as I explored the edible culture of my city with mom in tow. Kim Fay sits down with me to describe her inspiration for this tale of two women in two cities who develop a friendship over food. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
The level of familiarity I felt from the first page was really startling. Nearly every place, whether food-oriented or not, was part of my life growing up. Your book consists largely of letters sent back and forth between two women of different generations from 1962 to 1966, a span of time very familiar to me that included the Bay of Pigs, the Civil Rights Movement, and the emergence of the Beatles. Why did you decide to set the book in this period, and why an epistolary novel?
Well, those two choices go hand in hand. I've just always been come from the generation of letter writers, so I've always loved letter writing. And while most people have moved on and it's all text now, I still maintain a correspondence with my friend, the essayist Janet Brown, that began in 1995, and it continues to today. And over time, there have been moments when I thought I'd really love to write a novel in letters. And then when the opportunity arose at the beginning of the pandemic, the story naturally came in letters, and I needed a time period suited to the slowness of letters, suited to that pace, suited to the points in time where letter writing connected us, made a difference in our lives. And as I began exploring the various time periods, I knew I wanted it to be the 1960s, because as I'm sure you know, the character of the young food writer in Los Angeles in the book is based on Barbara Hansen, a food writer in Los Angeles in the 1960s.
So Imogen, the older, established food writer, is based outside of Seattle, while the younger Joan is in Los Angeles, where you live. Their correspondence takes flight when Joan sends Imogen a few threads of saffron and a recipe to make mussels that she learned while traveling. I know that you have spent a lot of time traveling and living abroad. Even though I know you pattern Joan to some extent on Barbara, how much of your younger self is in Joan?
I think much of my younger self is in Joan, especially because I began traveling outside of America when I was 21. And the one thing that's been consistent in all of my travels is the way that food has opened doors and the way that food has connected me wherever I've been. It doesn't matter the place. It doesn't matter the language barrier. It doesn't matter if I was 21 or if I was 41. No matter where I went, I can tell you the meals I ate, the people I ate them with, and the conversations that we had over those meals. And I feel that one of the places where Barbara and I connected, and then this came out through Joan, is culinary curiosity. It's the one thing in a country that draws me more than anything else. What are people putting on their tables? And so the young character of Joan is very much me in that respect.
Also, it's hard to communicate to people who didn't grow up in a period of time before the internet. The way one discovered food and recipes that weren't in one's immediate vicinity, either culture-wise or food section-wise, had a very different pace to it. And the back and forth between these two women in their letters feels so real to me and so natural, how they each use food to start to create an emotional bond and explore one another.
I think the reason it works in letters is because today, for example, let's say I want to tell my friend about a recipe. I send her a link. Done. In letters during this time period, you know, you couldn't just send someone to the internet. You couldn't just send someone down to the corner store to pick up an ingredient. And so as the women exchange letters and discuss food, it's part of the conversation. It becomes woven into the way they talk to one another. It's not just dropping a little bit of information here and there. And I think in that way, the way they share the recipes, the way they share the food they eat, the way they write about it, tells the reader so much about who they are as people.
And also, for me, the exploration that would happen when you wanted to find an ingredient. Like, I remember how hard it was to find saffron in the early 60s. I used to drive my mother nuts asking for rides to specialty stores she had never heard of because I had to find an ingredient.
I think it's interesting because I do think, especially young people, they think, oh, well, that was way back in the 50s, way back in the 60s. But I didn't start cooking until the early 1990s. I couldn't go to the grocery store and just pick up an ingredient. I was living in Seattle at the time. And I can remember going to the library and looking up a big catalog on specialty foods around the country and pouring through that. And then I would have to mail away for them.
They have this exchange of recipes for carne asada, which Joan shares with Imogen, and jerk chicken, which Imogen shares with Joan. They don't seem nearly as exotic in 2022 as they did to these to these two characters. Can you describe what she did? And then tell us what research you did about these kinds of recipes and how they were introduced to American audiences.
So in one of the letters, Imogen, who is the older magazine columnist up in Seattle, she mentions in a letter jerk chicken to Joan. Joan has never heard of this, even though she has a far more international palate, and she can't find a Jamaican restaurant in Los Angeles. So she asks Imogen to return to the person she heard about jerk chicken from and get the recipe. So Imogen goes to the university where her husband works, knocks on the door of the anthropology professor who had mentioned this dish, and sits down and attempts to write the instructions and write the ingredients while this very, let's just say, dramatic professor recounts her experiences in Jamaica and in the process describes the dish. I'd been working with Barbara Hansen for about 10 years, and I had always wanted to write about her. And so I'd spent a lot of time studying her old LA Times columns about different international foods. But that being said, I also have a collection of old cookbooks. And so I really hunted through cookbooks from that specific era because I also wanted to not only capture dishes that were unusual for the time, I wanted to make sure that I presented the dishes as they would have been presented at that time, which was a more Americanized version. If you look at the recipes in the novel for carne asada and for jerk chicken, they're fairly unsophisticated compared to what we would find now, because now we have access to far more authentic versions.
Yeah, I just would like to interject that when I opened my restaurant in 1984, there was no even Italian parsley at the grocery store.
Yes.
Or fresh basil. Or arugula.
Cilantro was exotic.
Yeah, cilantro was definitely exotic. Yeah, it's so interesting how things have developed.
And how quickly it changed.
So quickly. People were hungry for it.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And Los Angeles was the place for it, too. Because even when I went through the old LA Times archives in the 60s, Barbara wrote about the food of Egypt, Haiti, the Philippines, Colombia, Nicaragua, Uruguay. You just had to search a lot harder.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming here today and also for this just marvelous kind of love letter of a book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Evan. It's just a pleasure to be here.
Kim Fay lives in Los Angeles. Her second novel is Love and Saffron, a bite-sized afternoon read where a mutual love for food is the perfect recipe for friendship. The character of Joan in Kim Fay's novel Love and Saffron was inspired by Barbara Hansen, whose book, California Cooking Style, was a primer for exploring the state's diverse cuisine. Published in 1971, the same year Alice Waters opened Chez Panisse in Berkeley, Barbara celebrated the cooking of those who called California home. I'm so happy to have this opportunity to reminisce a bit with longtime Los Angeles food journalist Barbara Hansen about our wonderful city. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, that's so good to be with you.
Like myself, you're a native Angelina. Where in the city did you grow up?
I was born in Hollywood, and I grew up in the house where I am now, which is just a little ways east of the Grove.
What high school did you go to?
I went to a Catholic school, Immaculate Heart, because at the time I was in school, that my classes just weren't gelling. It wasn't going well. My mother heard that the academics were great at this Catholic convent school, and they were.
Yeah, I had so many friends growing up who went to an Immaculate Heart. Where were your parents from?
My mother came from Dubuque, Iowa. And my father, his parents immigrated from Denmark, and he was from Omaha, Nebraska.
So what was the food like in your house growing up?
Well, my mother did all the cooking. She wanted to mastermind that, and she was fabulous. It was her great outlet in life. She loved it. Meanwhile, as I was growing up and she was talking about shopping at the grocery store, I said, ooh, boring. But I overcame that later.
I know that during the time that you grew up, it was unusual for people to be focused on food. I know that I was looked askance and I came along a little after you did. When did you understand that food was going to be your through line as a career?
Well, you know, it came as a great surprise to me because through school, I was a disaster in home economics. I had no interest in any of it. But I think people are programmed to do what they're meant to do in this life. And that program starts, it could be in early childhood, like Mozart, who was composing at the age of 5, or it could come off much later. Like I didn't become interested in food and cooking until about 30 years old. And then I became obsessed by it.
What was it that precipitated the obsession?
You know, I have no idea, but suddenly it was there and I was just so interested. And it wasn't a case of wanting to go to cooking school and become a master chef or all that kind of thing. It was just a real, just an interest in food and where it came from, the people, the flavors. It was just so delightful. It was compelling.
When you started at the LA Times, was your beat right away food?
I've been working at another newspaper. And in those days, if you were a woman writer, you automatically went into the women's section. But while there, I met the daughter of Jean Volz, who was then the food editor of the LA Times. And someone had taken a leave or was on vacation, and they needed somebody to fill in. So there was the connection, and I went over and I stayed. Jean Volz was a superb editor, a real newswoman, and she loved food and the people involved. And I learned so much from her, and it was just a fabulous opportunity.
So what kind of stories did you mostly write? It's so different than it is now. Were there restaurant reviews, or was it mostly geared to the home cook?
Well, I got into restaurant reviews later. I would do things like go to women's club meetings and or fairs, maybe ethnic food fairs, and write about things there and meet those women and write their recipes. And it was so fascinating. And I think the human part of it is what especially appealed to me, because then food had a face, so to speak. So we did a great number of things. So obviously, it was a big section we had to write to fill. So sometimes we just grab stuff quickly out of the files and compose something around those recipes. But, you know, the section at one point, I think, went up to 55 pages. So we had a lot to do.
It's inconceivable now. Then you started writing a weekly column on Mexican food called Borderline. Who were you writing about in those early days?
For Borderline, I just wrote whatever interested me, and people would write in and request recipes, or they would send their own recipes, and I would use those. Got into going down to Tijuana, looking around, not on assignment, just I'd go with my mother and my sister. We just had fun walking around and eating, and I would pick up cookbooks down there, and it just mushroomed from a small beginning. And I was amazed at the response of the readers, because I think at that time, there were no sources available for they could learn this food that interested them so much.
And you were reporting throughout all of the waves of immigration to Los Angeles that also enlarged the city's food base. Can you tell us about some of those experiences you had?
Yeah, I got into all of that, mainly through the women and the people I met. I got into Japanese, Korean, South American, and European, Armenian, Greek, whatever. And sometimes we would get to know the cuisines through the consular offices who would hold events. But again, like I say, I often went to these various food fairs held by church groups and so forth, and then I learned about their cuisines there. And it was just fascinating. I saw the change from when cilantro was something unknown, and I got thrilled when I once found it in a Chinese market way off on downtown Los Angeles, way out of the mainstream. I thought, oh, look, and now, of course, these ingredients are all over the place and many more, but they were not available at that time.
Did you face any obstacles getting a foothold in the industry, or was it the fact that the food pages was really the women's section sort of cushioned that experience?
No obstacles at all. People were very welcoming, very, very friendly. And the food section was apart from the women's pages, although it would be regarded as a women's section because that's mainly who did the cooking.
Who were some writers that were kind of like mentors to you, food writers, or people you loved to read who inspired you?
Well, as I mentioned, Jean Volz, because she opened my eyes and she made it possible to do so many things, you know, to go out and interesting assignments. I'd drive down to San Pedro to go to a women's club meeting, and I'd go to the Norwegian Seamen's headquarters there and attend their events. And it was fascinating. If anything, I'm thinking of cookbooks that influenced me. The earliest one that was a great help to me was one called Mexican Cookbook for American Homes by Josefina Velasquez de Leon. This was a bilingual book, and this was how I started to learn to cook in Spanish and learn to use metric measures by working with that book. So that was very important. And of course, I met Julia Child early on, and what a great, great person to be around, just in informal events, not interviews. And I remember she once said to me, "Would you want to write about your friends?" In other words, how could she criticize anybody who was so close to her and whose efforts she admired so much? You know, efforts sometimes fall short. They're not always perfect.
So interesting. Do you have a particular reporting experience that stands out from others as being your most memorable or something that you think about and you cherish?
Really, the things that affected me most were travel experiences, that life-changing travel experiences, not just going and having a vacation. And one of those would have been my first trip to Mexico and a few subsequent trips, which awakened my eyes to this wonderful culture. And I don't mean just the food. I mean the people, the music, the crafts, everything they did. I was just overwhelmed by it. So that was a life changer. And then the next one would have been when I took a freighter trip throughout Southeast Asia. Oh my gosh, I had no idea. And I was able to experience these things firsthand. And then after that, later on at the end of the 80s, was my first trip to India. And again, it was a love match. So these were the influences more than writing and people. But I did meet very wonderful people along the way. People like Julie Sani, the Indian cookbook author, and especially Patricia Quintana, just one of the greats of Mexico, a magnificent writer and chef, but whose field of expertise was really history and archaeology.
Well, thank you so much, Barbara.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Barbara Hansen, cookbook author, food and wine writer, James Beard Award winner, and explorer. We've been reminiscing about Los Angeles, its people, its food, and its place in the global culinary community. You can find her writing at tableconversation.com and eatmx.com. In a minute, you don't have to wait for some deity to deliver properly made bagels to your city. You can DIY it. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. I'm the kind of bagel eater who believes that if you want blueberries or cinnamon in your bagels, then you are sadly misguided. There are two types of people in the world. Bagel purists, and people who think bagels should be soft or have a super open crumb. In many cities across the country, people are desperate for a properly made one. So if you're hosting a Mother's Day brunch and can't find a bagel that's quite up to snuff, how about making your own? They only require 5 ingredients. And once you know a few tricks, they're not that hard to make. Kathy Barrow shares how to achieve bagel perfection at home. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. I should say and acknowledge that you have a recipe for blueberry bagels. There is no disrespect meant towards you. Writing a cookbook is a different kind of endeavor.
This is true. And you'll note that they're under the imprimatur of bagels my grandmother wouldn't recognize.
Yes, I love that. So give us a brief history of the bagel.
Well, it is a history that is disputed, as any Jewish history must be, right? It's almost Talmudic. Many people believe the bagel started in Poland around 1614, but then there are others who say that it was the Ottomans who brought the Turkish simit to the Polish area and inspired the bagel, and that was much earlier.
Who taught you to bake bagels?
I taught myself. Years and years of trying and years of really terrible bagels.
So how did you turn the corner from imperfect, frustrating bagels to something that you can share with pride? Because they're not easy.
I think actually, if you have the correct ingredients, they're pretty straightforward. But I did not for a long time have access to those ingredients or even understand what they were. I read an article in the Washington Post in 2016 that outlined the benefits of high gluten flour, a high protein content, and it was like a lightning bolt. It had never occurred to me that there was something about the flour. I kept trying different things. I brought a bottle of water back from New York once to see if that would make a difference. It did not. Let me disabuse you of that belief. And It was when high gluten flour was part of the equation that bagels just rolled out of my oven exactly as they should.
So let's start with the five basic ingredients in Yiddish, the taklis, for making bagels and what each ingredient contributes.
So let's talk first about that flour. Most of us have all-purpose flour in the kitchen, and that has a protein level of 10.5, 10.9%. High gluten flour is 14 plus percent. Bread flour falls somewhere in the middle. The high gluten flour, that high protein level, gives you the shiny exterior shell, the crispness on the outside, and that really good chew. And without it, you can't achieve those qualities, which to me are the most important qualities in a bagel. You can make it yourself. King Arthur sells a high gluten flour, and it's great if you want a 50-pound bag at Restaurant Supply or 3 pounds mail ordered to you. But for many people, that's just a bridge too far. And also the idea of keeping multiple flours. So you can add something called vital wheat gluten flour, which is very inexpensive. And you only add 2 teaspoons to a cup of flour, and you have right there got that high protein.
I have to say that that exterior skin of the bagel, which is just bronzed and so shiny and has these tiny little bubbles that you can see underneath that skin, to me is what will make me reach for it with relief or feel a little sad if it's not there.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
So we have our flour. What else do we need?
Water. We've talked about that. It can be from your tap. It does not need to be cold or hot or warm, or it can just be straight from the tap. And if your water has any kind of aftertaste, minerality, sulfur, you should use bottled water. Because there are only 5 ingredients, funny tastes in your water could end up in your bagel. The next ingredient is salt. I use diamond crystal, and there is a difference between diamond crystal salt and Morton's kosher salt. Diamond crystal is far less salty. Morton's weighs twice as much. So in my recipe, if you're a Morton salt household, you should use half as much. Let's get to yeast. Yeast is very important. It's only in recent years that home bakers have had access to SAF instant yeast. And I love instant yeast because you can stir it right into your dry ingredients without that questionable moment of warm water, yeast, and are those enough bubbles, and is my yeast alive? It's like a question that I ask every time I've had to use the active dry yeast. So the introduction for me of instant yeast into my baking has changed everything.
Let's talk about the process of making the bagel. You make your dough.
Yes.
How important is kneading?
Kneading is very important. It establishes all of that good gluten and the strands. I put it in the stand mixer and let it rip for about 7 minutes.
Yeah, you need to have a strong stand mixer that can really stand up, so to speak, to a long beating.
If you don't walk away from it, because it will walk right off the counter.
We've used our ingredients properly. We've beaten the hell out of the dough, and then we form the bagels. What happens then?
Then they need a long, cool rise to develop flavor. The one ingredient we didn't talk about is barley malt syrup, a sweetener. And when you add that sweetener to the yeast and the flour and the water, sugar just makes the yeast go crazy. So if you left these bagels on the counter to rise, they would be ready to boil and then bake in about an hour, but they would be completely devoid of flavor. So we immediately put them in the refrigerator for anywhere from 8 to 14 hours so they can slowly develop that flavor and rise and get puffy.
You know, it's interesting. I always used the barley malt syrup in the water when it came time to boil the risen bagels.
Mm-hmm. Many people use it in the water, but it also has a place in the bagel itself. It provides a really nice aroma and a slightly sweet flavor.
So we have, our bagels have risen in the refrigerator and we've taken them out. Is this the time when we let them swim in boiling water?
Yes, when they come out of the refrigerator, your water should be boiling and your oven should be screaming hot. The bagels are lifted off of their nighttime bed and put right into that boiling water, and they bubble and boil for anywhere from 60 to 90 seconds. And at that point, when they're damp, that's when I like to put the seeds on generously.
Why do we boil the bagels before we bake them? And if we don't do that step, what happens?
We boil them to seal that exterior shell and to help develop that nice crackly crust. Partly when you boil it, it seals it, and then you put it in the oven and they expand and rise and they swell inside the shell rather than breaking it. If you don't boil them, you make a bialy.
Or a really bad bagel that you see at many bagel shops.
Correct. A dinner roll with a hole.
So I have to say that as parochial as I am about my bagels, when it comes to schmears, it's an entirely different thing. And I have to say, the schmears in your book are just very appetizing.
Thank you.
There's such a huge variety. Talk to us a little bit about some of them that might be new to people, things that you really enjoyed developing.
I loved making up the schmears. I would stand in front of my pantry doors and just say, I wonder how that would be with cream cheese. And I'm particularly proud of the Marcona almond and hot honey schmear, which is just delicious. The cannoli schmear was just a moment. I had some leftover candied orange peel from the holidays, and it occurred to me that with that and some mini chocolate chips that I also had in the pantry, I could make myself a cannoli cream cheese, and it worked beautifully. And then, of course, the standards, veggie cream cheese, olive cream cheese. I just love those. And one that is a bit of a Shonda, my favorite schmear at the Cape Cod Bagel Bakery was a bacon scallion schmear. It was so delicious. So it does have bacon in it.
I should say that a Shonda is a scandal. So you ask yourself the question, what's a party without a platter? Put together for us your metaphorical, fabulous platter.
When I do a bagel party and a big platter, I make mini bagels. I start there. And it means that you can try more schmears and have more different combinations. I'll always have bialys, and I love to include the pletzel, which is like a Jewish focaccia with a lot of onions on top. And then the fish. Must have belly lox or lox. Must have Nova. Must have kippered salmon.
What is the difference between those three?
So lox is cured, not smoked. Nova is cold smoked. And kippered salmon is hot smoked.
You know, during the last 10 years of her life, my mother lived with me, and every single day was shower, black coffee, toasted bagel with a schmear. If there was a day where we did not have bagels in the house, I had to leave the house.
See, bagels have memories too. But there's something about bagels, if you've grown up with the tradition, that just talking about it makes you really crave them.
This is really a fabulous book. I'm so glad that we were able to have you come by today. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you so much.
Ready to try your hand at bagels for brunch? Find all of Kathy Barrow's tricks of the trade in her book, Bagels, Schmears, and a Nice Piece of Fish. And head to kcrw.com/goodfood to find the recipe for her cannoli schmear. That's the place to put your cinnamon. In the third episode of Pachinko, an elderly Korean woman living in Japan, played by Academy Award winner Yoo Jung-yoon, waxes nostalgic about her homeland over a bowl of white rice. The emotion is completely lost on her grandson. We've had multiple discussions on Good Food about the legacy and complicated history that are contained in a few simple grains. Production designer Mara Lapierre-Schloop and prop master Ellen Freund worked hard to accurately represent 8 decades of food, cookware, and culinary history for the Apple TV Plus series. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Pachinko follows a Korean family through 8 decades, starting in rural 1930s Busan and ending in late 1980s Tokyo. And one of the most emotionally effective parts of the series, I felt, was these transitions within scenes that would go back and forth between generations. Can one of you explain the role of food in the series and its changing symbolism across generations?
In each era of the family, food plays a major part. And not only does it speak to where they are financially, where they're living, what sort of relationships they have, whether they're taking care of others, taking care of themselves, whether it's showing love or whether it's trying to convince someone of something.
The series is based on Min Jin Lee's novel. Is food as significant in the book as it is in the TV show?
The novel is so descriptive and experience and so much about process. And so food is a huge component of that. And true to any immigrant story or a story of displacement, when you lose all tangible objects, when you're forced to move from place to place or country to country, the only signifiers of your homeland are often language, cultural traditions, and food. And I think that it's a really brilliant device that Sue employed to kind of conjure back to different time periods, because the way Sue structured the series is we're jumping through time. It's not chronological like the novel is. And so whereas food in the novel becomes just kind of part of the rigorous detail in the television series, it becomes our entry into memory.
There's this scene in episode 3 where you find the elder Sunja, now living in Japan, recognizing that a bowl of white rice was grown in Korea by its nutty sweetness and texture. And then later it shows, we see the process in which her younger self is served white rice prepared by her mother on her wedding day. It was so beautifully choreographed. Ellen, that whole process of the washing and the making of the rice in the more traditional way, can you tell us a little bit about what your process was? And did the actor have to learn how to manage the more traditional pots and fire?
We started in Korea by gathering our actors together and taking them to a few different teachers who could help us with all of the different processes. So one of our first stops was to a house that was outside of Seoul, where the two young Sunjas and the mother were taught to make fire. They had an outdoor fireplace, and it was the home and workshop of a woman who had repeatedly won the kimchi making contests for years and years in Korea. That was our first stop. And then we went to Soojin Kim and we learned to wash the rice and cook the rice. And the washing of the rice with the little rattan baskets was a very specific move. The actors learned to use the basket to wash the rice and the correct flip of the wrist.
How did you go about finding the cookware that you would need for the different eras?
It was pretty difficult. Hamish Purdy, the set decorator, and I went over to Korea in advance. And we shopped antique markets. We shopped modern pottery places. It was difficult to find the quantity we needed of things, and it was also budgetary constraints and repeats. So, for instance, the cook pot where we cook the rice when we're in the village had to be a modern pot, a new pot, because I needed four of them so I could cut the bottom out, so I could add a window for the camera. And so I could do repeats of the beautiful crust of the rice. I had to source a pot that looked appropriate for 1930 or 1922 and then get a number of them. Dishware, it was the same. It was okay if it was cracked because it would have been cracked. I ended up not being able to use anything modern because it just felt wrong. It always felt too shiny or too matte. Or the shape was wrong. And so I ended up using mostly older dishes to give that feeling of it being appropriate. The rice bowl was another one that was a difficult decision because the one that worked best was the brass rice bowl. But there were many discussions about whether they would have been able to afford the brass or whether if they had brass, they would have sold it. The same way that we would discuss things like, yes, they had chickens, so they would have eggs, but wouldn't they sell the eggs rather than eat the eggs because they needed the money?
Were the scenes of the Busan fish market filmed in an actual fish market? How much of the seafood was real and how much of it was fake?
Oh, gosh, this was a real journey. We made pachinko during the pandemic and we stumbled into production in a very haphazard way without a full production plan when we first arrived in South Korea. We knew that if we started filming in October, that because of a number of reasons, we needed to be out by Christmas and we wouldn't be able to return because of visas and quarantines and all sorts of things. So we basically had this ticking clock of number of days we could shoot in South Korea. And number one on that list was the Busan fish market from the 1920s timeline, because we knew how hard it would be in Vancouver to source the product. So we searched, we looked everywhere in South Korea for this fish market location or a place we could build it or if what we could do. And long story short, we couldn't find it. So eventually we just had to concede it wasn't going to happen in South Korea. We did shoot the actual Jalgachi fish market in Busan for the 1989 storyline when Sunja goes home. And that was amazing. Thus began a half-year mission to source product for the market that we had to completely dress from scratch in Vancouver. We not only had to do it from scratch, but we also had to maintain it for 2.5 weeks of filming in a historic museum that wouldn't allow us to spill a single drop of water.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the sourcing of the fish and trying to find the correct fish and seafood and eels became very complicated to try and make them look appropriate for the era. And one of those things was the eels, to be able to source the correct eel and keep them alive and then substitute the dead eels, for which I made an animatronic eel that could wiggle on command.
And then the name of the show, Pachinko, I found kind of some irony in that there was never any food in the pachinko parlor.
That was actually something that I was very disappointed in the research to find, that there wasn't like a little cafeteria in pachinko parlors, because when we first started designing the set, we really wanted to bring that in some way to get more contemporary Japanese food and drinking. And what we found, and it's actually part of the set, was that people would often bring their own food, and there's actually refrigerated lockers in a lot of parlors, but there wouldn't be places for them to eat. They just eat at the machines. But the prize area of parlors, particularly in the 80s, were more like what we would imagine a grocery store to look like. There was a refrigerated section where you could win a durian or get a carton of cigarettes. And what we found in some of the research is that the prizes often, especially if they were stuffed animals or other things, there were actually stalls or windows around the corner from a lot of parlors where there'd be these under the table rackets where you'd bring the stuffed bunny that you won and you'd trade it in for cash. And we didn't get to really feed into that in this season. I'm not sure if that's going to be something that's touched upon later, but I'd love that detail.
That was Ellen Freund and Mara LaPierre-Schloop discussing the role and significance of food in the historical drama Pachinko. The full series is now available on Apple TV+.
Make 'em whistle like a missile, bomb, bomb. Every time I show up, lower, Make 'em whistle like a missile, bomb, bomb. Every time I show up,
up next, pucker up for a citrusy jaunt to the farmer's market. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market, where Ben Mims has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Ben Mims with the Market Report. We're here on a beautiful, sunny Sunday day at the Hollywood Farmers Market, and I'm speaking with Hannah Ziskin of Quarter Sheets and House of Gluten in Echo Park. Good morning, Hannah. How are you?
Hi, Ben. I'm doing great.
Tell us a little bit about House of Gluten, the cake business you started, which is now Quarter Sheets, with your partner doing pizza, and how that started from your home in Glendale to where you are now in Echo Park.
Yeah, like a lot of fledgling businesses, we started right as the pandemic did, and I just started producing at first bread and then pastries and then cakes out of our house in Glendale. At the same time, my partner Aaron started doing these Detroit and Sicilian style pizzas, and we kind of grew as much as we could grow, and we found this really cute tiny space in Echo Park, and so we've just moved in there. We opened in January.
Your cakes are very beautiful. They use lots of like flowers, and there's whole fruits sometimes too on these things. What goes into your mind about how you're going to design a cake?
Truly, it is dictated by whatever beautiful, organic, local, non-toxic, and or edible flowers I can find. In terms of flavors, I started working at Chez Panisse a long time ago and really taught me how to think about different types of fruit and seasonality. Things that grow together go together. There are these magic times between seasons. Like this is one of my favorite, when citrus season is turning into spring berry season and you have blood oranges and strawberries or Meyer lemons and blackberries at the same time. So it's the peak of both things happening at once, and that's like the best.
I love that. And so speaking of Meyer lemons, I know you're here today to pick up some because you're going to be using them in a cake.
I'll probably use them in a few ways, but right now I'm loving the Gaviota strawberries that are coming in from Temai, and I like cannot get enough. So I've been doing a cake that is a Meyer lemon Bavarian. So I make a Meyer lemon curd and then I buzz in some preserved Meyer lemon to that. So you get that deeper, richer, almost like earthiness from those lemons. And I'll pair it with a strawberry preserve.
So tell me, why do you love Meyer lemon so much? I mean, I know that people, you know, nowadays I feel like they're a little more common than they used to be back in the day. But what about their flavor versus a regular lemon?
I think that Meyer lemons have this really beautiful aroma that like Eureka lemons are lacking a bit, where you want that like sour from a lemon. Sometimes it can almost be like a floral aroma from the peel. And I love that you can use the whole fruit, especially perfect Meyer lemons. You can use the juice, you can use the peel, you can use the juice, candy the peel. It works well, you still get that flavor. And then when I started making my own preserved lemons, I would take the pith, blend that into things, and then candy the preserved lemon peel, which is a delicious, salty, sweet. It's almost like tamarind candy.
So the bitterness is probably not as strong as a Eureka lemon, so you can eat the peel kind of raw or kind of just cooked a little bit. Is that how you use it?
Yeah, and especially these lemons from JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch. You basically don't have to blanch them. They're so good.
That sounds amazing. What are some things, maybe some savory stuff, that you like to use Meyer lemons in?
I really enjoy roast chicken with pieces of just chopped up, again, whole Meyer lemon roasted on the pan with the chicken. So they get kind of crunchy and caramelized. I eat a lot of salad. So like tons of tahini, Meyer lemon, Lebna vinaigrette on like crunchy chicories.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
That was Hannah Ziskin of Quarter Sheets and House of Gluten in Echo Park. I'm here with Laura Ramirez of JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch in Redlands. Good morning, Laura. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Nice to see you this bright and early morning.
We just spoke with Hannah Ziskin of Quarter Sheets and House of Gluten in Echo Park. She uses your Meyer lemons for all the sheet cakes that she makes. And so I wanted to talk to you about the Meyer lemons you grow as well. And my first question is, what is a Meyer lemon?
Well, it's very controversial, I guess, because it's supposed to be either mixed with a mandarin or mixed with an orange. And everybody argues about it all the time. So I just think it's delicious. It's so smooth skinned. The zest is edible. And no wonder she makes sheet cakes. They're just so great. My mom used to make lemon bars that were delicious. She loved Meyer lemons. It was one of her favorites. And at this time of year, you know, the season is ending. So what she used to do is she used to juice them and put them in ice cube trays. And then we'd have them all year long.
What's the typical Meyer lemon season?
It's actually a December is normally when it is. It's a winter citrus. And normally it's ending in May. But we still have quite a few Meyer lemons. But at this time of year, they're going to be more orangey. And they're even more flavorful. So, and the peel is so soft and so fragrant and aromatic. And, oh, it is great. You can just eat it. It's so smooth and soft.
Do they get sweeter the older they get, like they later do. In the season? Is that what
they
it is?
Do. They taste a little more citrusy, like orange inside. They just look really orange on the outside now, too. But, you know, the shelf life is a little shorter now that they're getting a little softer and everything. So you could always put them in the refrigerator to make them last longer.
I know you said that you can kind of eat the whole peel, which is something unique for a lot of people to think about, even a Meyer lemon. Do you just eat the peel on its own, or do you...
You can eat the peel on its own. You can actually preserve the lemon, which makes a great preserved lemon. It's nice and soft. Zest is great, very aromatic. You know, you can put it in place of any kind of lemon because it's less acidic and it's just sweeter. And I myself like to put them in cocktails. So I love myself a martini with a little Meyer lemonade.
That sounds amazing. Thank you so much.
Nice seeing you.
That was Laura Ramirez of JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch in Redlands. For the Market Report, this is Ben Mims.
Just a reminder, if you listen to Good Food Live in 2 weeks, on May 21st, we're moving to our new time, 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. We'll be followed by The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on any podcast app or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laro Garcia, Tyler Boudreau, Ben Mims, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and Katie Gilchrist. And special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Tyne, Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. The LA restaurant of my youth that I miss the most is Casa de Ibarra. It was on Sunset Boulevard in Echo Park. Aside from a matchbook I bought on eBay, I've never found any information about it. So if you have any details of Casa de Ibarra or memories of the place, don't hesitate to drop me a line. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.